cool when you're dead. In fact, it's much easier because you aren't getting old and fat and losing your hair. Claire hums the beginning of When I'm 64. She moves her rook forward 5 spaces. I can checkmate her now, and I point this out to her, and she hastily takes back the move. So why do you like Paul? I ask her. I look up in time to see her blushing fervently.
He's so beautiful, Claire says.
There's something about the way she says it that makes me feel strange. I study the board, and it occurs to me that Claire could checkmate me if she took my bishop with her knight. I wonder if I should tell her this. If she was a little younger, I would. 12 is old enough to fend for yourself. Claire is staring dreamily at the board.
It dawns on me that I am jealous. Jesus, I can't believe I'm feeling jealous of a multimillionaire rock star geezer old enough to be Claire's dad.
Humph, I say. Claire looks up, smiling mischievously.
Who do you like?
You, I think, but don't say. Well, you mean when I was your age?
Yeah, when you were my age.
I weigh the value and potential of this nugget before I dole it out. I was your age in 1975. I'm 8 years older than you.
So you're 20?
Well, no, I'm 36. Old enough to be your dad. Claire furrows her brow. Math is not her strongest subject.
But if you were 12 in 1975...
Oh, sorry, you're right. I mean, I myself am 36, but somewhere out there, I wave my hand toward the south. I'm 20, in real time. Claire strives to digest this.
So there are 2 of you?
Not exactly. There's always only one me, but when I'm time traveling, sometimes I go somewhere I already am, and yeah, then you could say there are 2. Or more.
How come I never see more than one?
You will. When you and I meet in my present, that will happen fairly frequently. More often than I'd like, Claire.
So who did you like in 1975?
Nobody, really. At 12, I had other stuff to think about. But when I was 13, I had this huge crush on Patty Hearst. Claire looks annoyed.
A girl you knew at school?
I laugh. No. She was a rich Californian college girl who got kidnapped by these awful left-wing political terrorists, and they made her rob banks. She was on the news every night for months.
What happened to her? Why did you like her?
They eventually let her go, and she got married and had kids, and now she's a rich lady in California. Why did I like her? I don't know. It's irrational, you know? I guess I kind of knew how she felt, being taken away and forced to do stuff she didn't want to do, and then it seemed like she was kind of enjoying it.
Do you do things you don't want to do?
Yeah, all the time. My leg has fallen asleep, and I stand up and shake it until it tingles. I don't always end up safe and sound with you, Claire. A lot of times I go places where I have to get clothes and food by stealing.
Oh.
Her face clouds. And then she sees her move and makes it, and looks up at me triumphantly.
Checkmate!
Hey, bravo! I salaam her. You are the chess queen du jour.
Yes, I am,
Claire says, pink with pride. She starts to set the pieces back in their starting positions.
Again?
I pretend to consult my non-existent watch.
Sure.
I sit down again. You hungry? We've been out here for hours, and supplies have run low. All we have left is the dregs of a bag of Doritos.
Mm-hmm.
Claire holds the pawns behind her back. I tap her right elbow, and she shows me the white pawn. I make my standard opening move, queen's pawn to Q4. She makes her standard response to my standard opening move, queen's pawn to Q4. We play out the next 10 moves fairly rapidly, with only moderate bloodshed, and then Claire sits for a while, pondering the board. She is always experimenting, always attempting the coup d'éclat.
"Who do you like now?" she asks without looking up.
"You mean at 20 or at 36?
"Both."
I try to remember being 20. It's just a blur of women, breasts, legs, skin, hair. All their stories have jumbled together and their faces no longer attach themselves to names. I was busy but miserable at 20. 20 was nothing special. Nobody springs to mind.
And 36?
I scrutinize Claire.
Is 12 too young?
I'm sure 12 is really too young. Better to fantasize about beautiful, unattainable, safe Paul McCartney than to have to contend with Henry the time-traveling geezer.
Why is she asking this anyway?
Henry?
Yeah?
Are you married?
Yes, I admit reluctantly.
To who?
A very beautiful, patient, talented, smart woman. Her face falls.
Oh.
She picks up one of my white bishops, which she captured 2 moves ago, and spins it on the ground like a top.
Well, that's nice.
She seems kind of put out by this news.
What's wrong?
Nothing. Claire moves her queen from Q2 to KN5.
Check.
I move my knight to protect my king.
Am I married?
Claire inquires. I meet her eyes.
You're pushing your luck today.
Why not? You never tell me anything anyway. Come on, Henry. Tell me if I'm going to be an old maid.
You're a nun, I tease her.
Claire shudders. Boy, I hope not. She takes one of my pawns with her rook.
How did you meet your wife?
Sorry, top secret information.
I take her rook with my queen. Claire makes a face.
Ouch.
Were you time-traveling when you met her?
I was minding my own business. Claire sighs. She takes another pawn with her other rook. I'm starting to run low on pawns. I move Queen's Bishop to KB4.
It's not fair that you know everything about me, but you never tell me anything about you.
True. It's not fair. I try to look regretful and obliging.
I mean, Ruth and Helen and Megan and Laura tell me everything, and I tell them everything.
Everything?
Yeah?
Well, I don't tell them about you.
Oh, why's that?
Claire looks a bit defensive.
You're a secret. They wouldn't believe me anyway.
She traps my bishop with her knight, flashes me a sly smile. I contemplate the board, trying to find a way to take her knight or move my bishop. Things are looking grim for White.
Henry, are you really a person?
I am a bit taken aback.
Yes?
What else would I be?
I don't know. A spirit?
I'm really a person, Claire.
Prove it.
How?
I don't know.
I mean, I don't think you could prove that you're a person, Claire.
Sure I can.
How?
I'm just like a person.
Well, I'm just like a person, too. It's funny that Claire is bringing this up. Back in 1999, Dr. Kendrick and I are engaged in philosophical trench warfare over this very issue. Kendrick is convinced that I am a harbinger of a new species of human, as different from everyday folks as Cro-Magnon man was from his Neanderthal neighbors. I contend that I'm just a piece of messed up code, and our inability to have kids proves that I'm not going to be the missing link. We've taken to quoting Kierkegaard and Heidegger at each other and glowering. Meanwhile, Claire regards me doubtfully.
People don't appear and disappear the way you do. You're like the Cheshire Cat.
Are you implying that I'm a fictional character?
I spot my move, finally. King's rook to QR3. Now, she can take my bishop, but she'll lose her queen in the process.
It takes Claire a moment to realize this, and when she does, she sticks out her tongue at me. Her tongue is a worrisome shade of orange from all the Doritos she's eaten. It makes me kind of wonder about fairy tales. I mean, if you're real, then why shouldn't fairy tales be real, too? Claire stands up, still pondering the board, and does a little dance, hopping around like her pants are on fire. I think the ground's getting harder. My butt's asleep. Maybe they are real. Or some little thing in them is real, and then people just added to it, you know? Like, maybe Snow White was in a coma? And Sleeping Beauty, too. And Jack the Beanstalk guy was just a real terrific gardener. And Noah was a weird old man with a houseboat and a lot of cats. Claire stares at me.
Noah is in the Bible. He's not a fairy tale.
Oh, right. Sorry. I'm getting very hungry. Any minute now, Nell will ring the dinner bell and Claire will have to go in. She sits back down on her side of the board. I can tell she's lost interest in the game when she starts building a little pyramid out of all the conquered pieces.
You still haven't proved you're real,
Claire says. Neither of you?
Do you ever wonder if I'm real?
She asks me, surprised. Maybe I'm dreaming you. Maybe you're dreaming me. Maybe we only exist in each other's dreams, and every morning when we wake up, we forget all about each other. Claire frowns and makes a motion with her hand as though to bat away this odd idea.
Pinch me, she requests.
I lean over and pinch her lightly on the arm.
Harder.
I do it again, hard enough to leave a white and red mark that lingers for some seconds and then vanishes.
Don't you think I would wake up if I was asleep? Anyway, I don't feel asleep.
Well, I don't feel like a spirit or a fictional character.
How do you know? I mean, if I was making you up, and I didn't want you to know you were made up, I just wouldn't tell you, right?
I wiggle my eyebrows at her. Maybe God just made us up, and he's not telling us.
You shouldn't say things like that, Claire exclaims. Besides, you don't even believe in God, do you?
I shrug and change the subject. I'm more real than Paul McCartney. Claire looks worried. She starts to put all the pieces back in their box, carefully dividing white and black.
Lots of people know about Paul McCartney.
I'm the only one who knows about you. But you've actually met me, and you've never met him.
My mom went to a Beatles concert.
She closes the lid of the chess set and stretches out on the ground, staring up at the canopy of new leaves.
It was at Comiskey Park in Chicago, August 8, 1965.
I poke her in the stomach and she curls up like a hedgehog, giggling. After an interval of tickling and thrashing around, we lie on the ground with our hands clasped across our middles, and Claire asks,
"Is your wife a time traveler, too?"
"Nope, thank God."
"Why thank God? I think that would be fun. You could go places together."
One time traveler per family is more than enough. It's dangerous, Claire.
Does she worry about you?
Yes, I say softly. She does. I wonder what Claire is doing now in 1999. Maybe she's still asleep. Maybe she won't know I'm gone.
Do you love her?
Very much, I whisper. We lie silently side by side, watching the swaying trees, the birds, the sky. I hear a muffled sniffling noise, and glancing at Claire, I am astonished to see the tears are streaming across her face toward her ears. I sit up and lean over her.
"What's wrong, Claire?"
She just shakes her head back and forth and presses her lips together. I smooth her hair and pull her into a sitting position, wrap my arms around her. She's a child, and then again, she isn't.
"What's wrong?"
It comes out so quietly that I have to ask her to repeat it.
"It's just that I thought maybe you were married to me."
Wednesday, June 27th, 1984. Claire is 13. I am standing in the meadow. It's late June, late afternoon. In a few minutes it will be time to wash up for supper. The temperature's dropping. 10 minutes ago the sky was coppery blue and there was a heavy heat over the meadow. Everything felt curved, like being under a vast glass dome, all near noises swallowed up in the heat while an overwhelming chorus of insects droned. I've been sitting on the tiny footbridge, watching water bugs skating on the still, small pool, thinking about Henry. Today isn't a Henry day. The next one is 22 days away. It is now much cooler. Henry is puzzling to me. All my life, I have pretty much just accepted Henry as no big deal. That is, although Henry is a secret, and therefore automatically fascinating, Henry is also some kind of miracle. And just recently it started to dawn on me that most girls don't have a Henry, or if they do, they've all been pretty quiet about it. There's a wind coming. The tall grass is rippling, and I close my eyes so it sounds like the sea, which I have never seen except on TV. When I open them, the sky is yellow and then green. Henry says he comes from the future. When I was little, I didn't see any problem with that. I didn't have any idea what it might mean. Now I wonder if it means that the future is a place, or like a place, that I could go to, that is, go to in some way other than just getting older. I wonder if Henry could take me to the future. The woods are black, and the trees bend over and whip to the side and bow down. The insect hum is gone, and the wind is smoothing everything. The grass is flat, and the trees are creaking and groaning. I am afraid of the future. It seems to be a big box waiting for me. Henry says he knows me in the future. Huge black clouds are moving up from behind the trees. They come up so suddenly that I laugh. They are like puppets, and everything is swirling toward me, and there is a long, low peal of thunder. I am suddenly aware of myself, standing thin and upright in a meadow where everything has flattened itself down, and so I lie down, hoping to be unnoticed by the storm which rolls up, and I am flat on my back, looking up when water begins to pour down from the sky. My clothes are soaked in an instant, and I suddenly feel that Henry is there, an incredible need for Henry to be there and to put his hands on me, even while it seems to me that Henry is the rain, and I am alone and wanting him.
Sunday, September 23rd, 1984. Henry is 35. Claire is 13. I am in the clearing, in the meadow. It's very early in the morning, just before dawn. It's late summer. All the flowers and grasses are up to my chest. It's chilly. I am alone. I wade through the plants and locate the clothes box, open it up and find blue jeans and a white Oxford shirt and flip-flops. I've never seen these clothes before, so I have no idea where I am in time. Claire has also left me a snack. There's a peanut butter and jelly sandwich carefully wrapped in aluminum foil with an apple and a bag of Jay's potato chips. Maybe this is one of Claire's school lunches. My expectations veer in the direction of the late 70s or early 80s. I sit down on the rock and eat the food, and then I feel much better. The sun is rising. The whole meadow is blue, and then orange, and pink. The shadows are elongated, and then it is day. There's no sign of Claire. I crawl a few feet into the vegetation, curl up on the ground even though it is wet with dew, and sleep. When I wake up, the sun is higher and Claire is sitting next to me reading a book. She smiles at me and says, "Daylight in the swamp. The birds are singing and the frogs are croaking and it's time to get up." I groan and rub my eyes. "Hi, Claire. What's the date?" "Sunday, September 23rd, 1984. Claire is 13. A strange and difficult age, but not as difficult as what we're going through in my present. I sit up and yawn. "Claire, if I asked very nicely, would you go into your house and smuggle out a cup of coffee for me?" "Coffee?" Claire says this as though she's never heard of the substance. As an adult, she is as much of an addict as I am. She considers the logistics. Pretty, please?
Okay, I'll try.
She stands up slowly. This is the year Claire got tall, quickly. In the past year, she has grown 5 inches, and she has not yet become accustomed to her new body. Breasts and legs and hips all newly minted. I try not to think about it as I watch her walk up the path to the house. I glance at the book she was reading. It's a Dorothy Sayers, one I haven't read. I'm on page 33 by the time she gets back. She has brought a thermos, cups, a blanket, and some donuts. A summer's worth of sun has freckled Claire's nose, and I have to resist the urge to run my hands through her bleached hair, which falls over her arms as she spreads out the blanket. Bless you. I receive the thermos as though it contains a sacrament. We settle ourselves on the blanket. I kick off the flip-flops, pour out a cup of coffee, and take a sip. It's incredibly strong and bitter. Yowza, this is rocket fuel, Claire. Too strong? She looks a little depressed, and I hasten to compliment her. Well, there's probably no such thing as too strong, but it's pretty strong. I like it, though. Did you make it?
Uh-huh.
I never made coffee before, and Mark came in and was kind of bugging me, so maybe I did it wrong. No, it's fine. I blow on the coffee and gulp it down. I feel better immediately. I pour another cup. Claire takes the thermos from me. She pours herself 1/2 inch of coffee and takes a cautious sip.
Ugh, she says. This is disgusting. Is it supposed to taste like this?
Well, it's usually a little less ferocious. You like yours with lots of cream and sugar. Claire pours the rest of her coffee into the meadow and takes a donut. Then she says, "You're making me into a freak." I don't have a ready reply for this, since the idea has never occurred to me. No, I'm not.
You are so?
Am not? I pause. What do you mean, I'm making you into a freak?
I'm not making you into anything.
You know, like telling me that I like coffee with cream and sugar before I hardly even taste it? I mean, how am I going to figure out if that's what I like or if I just like it because you tell me I like it? But Claire, it's just personal taste. You should be able to figure out how you like coffee whether I say anything or not. Besides, you're the one who's always bugging me to tell you about the future.
Knowing the future is different from being told what I like, Claire says.
Why? It's all got to do with free will. Claire takes off her shoes and socks. She pushes the socks into the shoes and places them neatly at the edge of the blanket. Then she takes my cast-off flip-flops and aligns them with her shoes, as though the blanket is a tatami mat.
I thought free will had to do with sin.
I think about this. No, I say. Why should free will be limited to right and wrong? I mean, you just decided of your own free will to take off your shoes. It doesn't matter. Nobody cares if you wear shoes or not, and it's not sinful or virtuous, and it doesn't affect the future, but you've exercised your free will. Claire shrugs.
But sometimes you tell me something, and I feel like the future is already there, you know? Like my future has happened in the past, and I can't do anything about it.
That's called determinism, I tell her. It haunts my dreams. Claire is intrigued.
Why?
Well, if you are feeling boxed in by the idea that your future is unalterable, imagine how I feel. I'm constantly running up against the fact that I can't change anything, even though I'm right there watching it.
But Henry, you do change things. I mean, you wrote down that stuff that I'm supposed to give you in 1991 about the baby with Down syndrome. And the list? If I didn't have the list, I would never know when to come meet you. You change things all the time.
I smile. I can only do things that work toward what has already happened. I can't, for example, undo the fact that you just took off your shoes. Claire laughs. Why would you care if I take them off or not?
I don't. But even if I did, it's now an unalterable part of the history of the universe, and I can't do a thing about it. I help myself to a donut. It's a Bismarck, my favorite. The frosting is melting in the sun a little, and it sticks to my fingers. Claire finishes her donut, rolls up the cuffs of her jeans, and sits cross-legged. She scratches her neck and looks at me with annoyance.
Now you're making me self-conscious. I feel like every time I blow my nose, it's a historic event.
Well, it is. She rolls her eyes.
What's the opposite of determinism?
Chaos.
Oh. I don't think I like that. Do you like that?
I take a big bite out of the Bismarck and consider chaos. Well, I do, and I don't. Chaos is more freedom. In fact, total freedom. But no meaning. I want to be free to act, and I also want my actions to mean something.
But Henry, you're forgetting about God.
Why can't there be a God who makes it mean something?
Claire frowns earnestly and looks away across the meadow as she speaks. I pop the last of the Bismarck into my mouth and chew slowly to gain time. Whenever Claire mentions God, my palms start to sweat and I have an urge to hide or run or vanish. I don't know, Claire. I mean, to me, things seem too random and meaningless for there to be a God. Claire clasps her arms around her knees.
But you just said before that, everything seems like it's all planned out beforehand.
I say. I grab Claire's ankles, pull her feet onto my lap, and hold on. Claire laughs and leans back on her elbows. Claire's feet are cold in my hands. They are very pink and very clean. Okay, I say. Let's see. The choices we're working with here are a block universe, where past, present, and future all coexist simultaneously and everything has already happened. Chaos, where anything can happen and nothing can be predicted because we can't know all the variables. And a Christian universe in which God made everything and it's all here for a purpose, but we have free will anyway. Right? Claire wiggles her toes at me.
I guess.
And what do you vote for? Claire is silent. Her pragmatism and her romantic feelings about Jesus and Mary are, at 13, almost equally balanced. A year ago, she would have said God, without hesitation. In 10 years, she will vote for determinism, and 10 years after that, Claire will believe that the universe is arbitrary, that if God exists, he does not hear our prayers, that cause and effect are inescapable and brutal, but meaningless.
And after that, I don't know.
But right now, Claire sits on the threshold of adolescence, with her faith in one hand and her growing skepticism in the other, and all she can do is try to juggle them or squeeze them together until they fuse. She shakes her head.
I don't know. I want God.
Is that okay?
I feel like an asshole.
Of course it's okay. That's what you believe. But I don't want to just believe it. I want it to be true.
I run my thumbs across Claire's arches, and she closes her eyes. You and St. Thomas Aquinas both, I say.
I've heard of him,
Claire says, as though she's speaking of a long-lost favorite uncle, or the host of a TV show she used to watch when she was little. He wanted order and reason, and God, too. He lived in the 13th century and taught at the University of Paris. Aquinas believed in both Aristotle and angels.
I love angels, says Claire. They're so beautiful.
I wish I could have wings and fly around and sit on clouds.
Ein jeder Engel ist schrecklich.
Claire sighs, a little soft sigh that means,
I don't speak German, remember?
Huh?
Every angel is terrifying. It's part of a series of poems called the Duino Elegies by a poet named Rilke. He's one of our favorite poets. Claire laughs.
You're doing it again!
What?
Telling me what I like!
Claire burrows into my lap with her feet. Without thinking, I put her feet on my shoulders, but then that seems too sexual somehow, and I quickly take Claire's feet in my hands again and hold them together with one hand in the air as she lies on her back, innocent and angelic, with her hair spread nimbus-like around her on the blanket. I tickle her feet. Claire giggles and twists out of my hands like a fish, jumps up and does a cartwheel across the clearing, grinning at me as if to dare me to come and get her. I just grin back, and she returns to the blanket and sits down next to me.
Henry.
Yeah?
You are making me different.
I know. I turn to look at Claire, and just for a moment I forget that she is young, and that this is long ago. I see Claire, my wife, superimposed on the face of this young girl, and I don't know what to say to this Claire, who is old and young and different from other girls, who knows that different might be hard. But Claire doesn't seem to expect an answer. She leans against my arm, and I put my arm around her shoulders.
Claire!
Across the quiet of the meadow, Claire's dad is bellowing her name. Claire jumps up and grabs her shoes and socks.
It's time for church,
she says, suddenly nervous. Okay, I say. Bye. I wave at her, and she smiles and mumbles goodbye, and is running up the path and is gone. I lie in the sun for a while, wondering about God, reading Dorothy Sayers. After an hour or so has passed, I too am gone, and there is only a blanket and a book, coffee cups and clothing, to show that we were there at all.
After the end. Saturday, October 27th, 1984. Claire is 13. Henry is 43. I wake up suddenly. There was a noise. Someone called my name. It sounded like Henry. I sit up in bed listening. I hear the wind and crows calling. But what if it was Henry? I jump out of bed, and I run. With no shoes, I run downstairs, out the back door, into the meadow. It's cold. The wind cuts right through my nightgown. Where is he? I stop and look, and there by the orchard, there's Daddy and Mark in their bright orange hunting clothes, and there's a man with them. They are all standing and looking at something, but then they hear me, and they turn, and I see that the man is Henry. What is Henry doing with Daddy and Mark? I run to them, my feet cut by the dead grasses, and Daddy walks to meet me. Sweetheart, he says, what are you doing out here so early? I heard my name, I say. He smiles at me. Silly girl, his smile says, and I look at Henry to see if he will explain. Why did you call me Henry? But he shakes his head and puts his finger to his lips. Shh, don't tell Claire. He walks into the orchard, and I want to see what they were looking at, but there's nothing there, and Daddy says, go back to bed, Claire. It was just a dream. He puts his arm around me and begins to walk back toward the house with me, and I look back at Henry, and he waves. He's smiling. It's okay, Claire. I'll explain later. Although knowing Henry, he probably won't explain. He'll make me figure it out, or it will explain itself one of these days. I wave back at him, and then I check to see if Mark saw that. But Mark has his back to us. He's irritated and is waiting for me to go away so he and Daddy can go back to hunting. But what is Henry doing here? What did they say to each other? I look back again, but I don't see Henry, and Daddy says, go on now, Claire, go back to bed. And he kisses my forehead. He seems upset, and so I run back to the house, and then softly up the stairs, and then I am sitting on my bed, shivering, and I still don't know what just happened. But I know it was bad. It was very, very bad. Monday, February 2nd, 1987. Claire is 15. Henry is 38. When I get home from school, Henry is waiting for me in the reading room. I have fixed a little room for him next to the furnace room. It's on the opposite side from where all the bicycles are. I have allowed it to be known in my household that I like to spend time in the basement reading, and I do, in fact, spend a lot of time in here so that it doesn't seem unusual. Henry has a chair wedged under the doorknob. I knock four knocks, and he lets me in. He has made a sort of nest out of pillows and chair cushions and blankets. He's been reading old magazines under my desk lamp. He is wearing Dad's old jeans and a plaid flannel shirt, and he looks tired and unshaven. I left the back door unlocked for him this morning, and here he is. I set the tray of food I have brought on the floor. I could bring down some books.
Actually, these are great.
He's been reading Mad magazines from the 60s.
And this is indispensable for time travelers who need to know all sorts of factoids at a moment's notice,
he says, holding up the 1968 World Almanac. I sit down next to him on the blankets and look over at him to see if he's going to make me move. I can see he's thinking about it, so I hold up my hands for him to see, and then I sit on them. He smiles.
Make yourself at home, he says.
When are you coming from?
2001, October.
You look tired. I can see that he's debating about telling me why he's tired and decides against it. What are we up to in 2001?
Big things. Exhausting things.
Henry starts to eat the roast beef sandwich I have brought him.
Hey, this is good.
Nell made it.
He laughs. I'll never understand why it is that you can build huge sculptures that withstand gale force winds, deal with dye recipes, cook Kozo and all that, and you can't do anything whatsoever with food. It's amazing.
It's a mental block. A phobia.
It's weird.
I walk into the kitchen, and I hear this little voice saying, go away. So I do.
Are you eating enough? You look thin.
I feel fat. I'm eating. I have a dismal thought. Am I very fat in 2001? Maybe that's why you think I'm too thin.
Henry smiles at some joke I don't get. Well, you're kind of plump at the moment in my present, but it will pass.
Ugh.
Plump is good. It will look very good on you.
No, thanks. Henry looks at me, worrying. You know, I'm not anorexic or anything. I mean, you don't have to worry about it.
Well, it's just that your mom was always bugging you about it.
Was?
Is.
Why did you say was?
No reason. Lucille is fine, don't worry.
He's lying. My stomach tightens, and I wrap my arms around my knees and put my head down.
I cannot believe that I've made a slip of the tongue of this magnitude. I stroke Claire's hair, and I wish fervently that I could go back to my present for just a minute, long enough to consult Claire to find out what I should say to her at 15 about her mother's death. It's because I'm not getting any sleep. If I was getting some sleep, I would have been thinking faster, at least covering better for my lapse. But Claire, who is the most truthful person I know, is acutely sensitive to even small lies. And now the only alternatives are to refuse to say anything, which will make her frantic, or to lie, which she won't accept, or to tell the truth, which will upset her and do strange things to her relationship with her mother. Claire looks at me. Tell me, she says.
Henry looks miserable.
I can't, Claire.
Why not?
It's not good to know things ahead. It screws up your life.
Yes, but you can't half tell me.
There's nothing to tell.
I'm really beginning to panic. She killed herself. I am flooded with certainty. It is the thing I have always feared most.
No, no, absolutely not.
I stare at him. Henry just looks very unhappy. I cannot tell if he is telling the truth. If I could only read his mind, how much easier life would be. Mama. Oh, Mama.
This is dreadful. I can't leave Claire with this. Ovarian cancer. I say very quietly. Thank God, she says, and begins to cry.
Friday, June 5th, 1987. Claire is 16. Henry is 32. I've been waiting all day for Henry. I'm so excited. I got my driver's license yesterday, and Daddy said I could take the Fiat to Ruth's party tonight. Mama doesn't like this at all. But since Daddy has already said yes, she can't do much about it. I can hear them arguing in the library after dinner. You could have asked me.
It seemed harmless, Lucy.
I take my book and walk out to the meadow. I lie down in the grass. The sun is beginning to set. It's cool out here, and the grass is full of little white moths. The sky is pink and orange over the trees in the west, and an arc of deepening blue over me. I am thinking about going back to the house and getting a sweater when I hear someone walking through the grass. Sure enough, it's Henry. He enters the clearing and sits down on the rock. I spy on him from the grass. He looks fairly young, early 30s maybe. He's wearing the plain black t-shirt and jeans and high tops. He's just sitting quietly, waiting. I can't wait a minute longer myself, and I jump up and startle him.
Jesus, Claire, don't give the geezer a heart attack.
You're not a geezer. Henry smiles. He's funny about being old. Kiss, I demand, and he kisses me.
What was that for?
He asks. I got my driver's license. Henry looks alarmed.
Oh, no. I mean, congratulations.
I smile at him. Nothing he says can ruin my mood. You're just jealous.
I am, in fact. I love to drive, and I never do.
How come?
Too dangerous.
Chicken.
I mean for other people. Imagine what would happen if I was driving and I disappeared. The car would still be moving, and kaboom. Lots of dead people and blood. Not pretty.
I sit down on the rock next to Henry. He moves away. I ignore this. I'm going to a party at Ruth's tonight. Want to come? He raises one eyebrow. This usually means he's going to quote from a book I've never heard of or lecture me about something. Instead, he only says,
But Claire, that would involve meeting a whole bunch of your friends.
Why not? I'm tired of being all secretive about this.
Let's see, you're 16, I'm 32 right now, only twice your age. I'm sure no one would even notice, and your parents would never hear about it.
I sigh. Well, I have to go to this party. Come with and sit in the car, and I won't stay in very long, and then we can go somewhere.
We park about a block away from Ruth's house. I can hear the music all the way down here. It's Talking Heads once in a lifetime. I actually kind of wish I could go with Claire, but it would be unwise. She hops out of the car and says, Stay, as though I'm a large, disobedient dog, and totters off in her heels and short skirt towards Ruth's. I slump down and wait.
As soon as I walk in the door, I know this party is a mistake. Ruth's parents are in San Francisco for a week, so at least she will have some time to repair, clean, and explain. But I'm glad it's not my house all the same. Ruth's older brother Jake has also invited his friends, and altogether there are about 100 people here, and all of them are drunk. There are more guys than girls, and I wish I had worn pants and flats, but it's too late to do anything about it. As I walk into the kitchen to get a drink, someone behind me says,
Check out Miss Look But Don't Touch,
and makes an obscene burping sound. I spin around and see the guy we call Lizard Face, because of his acne, leering at me.
Nice dress, Claire.
Thanks, but it's not for your benefit, Lizard Face. He follows me into the kitchen.
Now that's not a very nice thing to say, young lady. After all, I'm just trying to express my appreciation of your extremely comely attire, and all you can do is insult me.
He won't shut up. I finally escape by grabbing Helen and using her as a human shield to get out of the kitchen. This sucks, says Helen. Where's Ruth? Ruth is hiding upstairs in her bedroom with Laura. They are smoking a joint in the dark and watching out the window as a bunch of Jake's friends skinny dip in the pool. Soon we are all sitting in the window seat, gawking. Says Helen. I'd like some of that. Which one? Ruth asks. The guy on the diving board.
Ooh.
Look at Ron, says Laura. That's Ron? Ruth giggles.
Wow. Well, I guess anyone would look better without the Metallica t-shirt and the skanky leather vest.
Helen says. Hey, Claire, you're awfully quiet.
Yeah, I guess, I say weakly.
Look at you, says Helen. You are like cross-eyed with lust. I am ashamed of you. How could you let yourself get into such a state?
She laughs. Seriously, Claire, why don't you just get it over with?
I can't, I say miserably.
Sure you can. Just walk downstairs and yell, fuck me, and about 50 guys would be yelling, me, me.
You don't understand. I don't want... It's not that.
She wants somebody in particular, Ruth says, without taking her eyes off the pool.
Who? Helen asks.
I shrug my shoulders.
Come on, Claire, spit it out.
Leave her alone, Laura says. If Claire doesn't want to say, she doesn't have to.
I am sitting next to Laura, and I lean my head on her shoulder. Helen bounces up. I'll be right back.
Where are you going?
I brought some champagne and pear juice to make Bellinis, but I left it in the car.
She dashes out the door. A tall guy with shoulder-length hair does a backward somersault off the diving board.
Oh la la, say Ruth and Laura in unison.
A long time has passed, maybe an hour or so. I eat half the potato chip,